We're now in day 24 of the partial government shutdown. Thousands of federal employees deemed essential are now working without pay. Among those are uniformed members of the U.S. Coast Guard. Commandant Admiral Carl Schultz reached out to them in a post promising they've not been forgotten, as tomorrow is supposed to be a payday for the Guard. Their last paycheck was New Year's Eve. The Coast Guard will still carry out missions related to national security and public safety during the shutdown, though the Military Times reports close to 10,000 workers are furloughed. Here's Chief Petty Officer Sarah Muir, Public Affairs Officer for the Coast Guard's 14th District.
The Coast Guard is continuing operations authorized by law that provide for national security or that protect life or property during this partial government shutdown. There are some impacts to our day-to-day operations, but the Coast Guard stops or curtails mission activities that don't fall into those categories. Things like search and rescue, port and homeland safety and security, law enforcement, and environmental response. So our uniformed personnel and essential civilians are continuing to perform those duties during the partial shutdown. We are trying to maintain mission readiness, but obviously some of that is impacted by the restrictions that we're experiencing. We have had to reduce some of our operations, and we did cancel some domestic fisheries patrols that were planned. So we're responding to emergent issues that come up, whether those are search and rescue, law enforcement related. We're continuing some patrols, but we are starting to see some of those impacts on missions that were planned after the new year.
Public safety and national security requirements haven't diminished during the shutdown. A New Year's Eve catastrophic fire on a cargo ship some 2,000 miles off Hawaii tapped local Coast Guard units. You may recall the Coast Guard was affected by a 16-day shutdown in 2013. Rear Admiral Kerry Thomas was in command of the 14th District during that shutdown. She's since retired and now runs a nonprofit organization, Coast Guard Mutual Assistance, which helps Coast Guard members in financial stress. Admiral Thomas spoke with HPR's Ryan Finnerty about her experience in command during a government shutdown.
During normal times in the 14th District, of course, it's the largest of all the geographic districts. And from Hawaii to Guam to American Samoa to Singapore, everything in between, there's ships on patrol doing law enforcement. There's people on the islands responding to search and rescue cases. There are environmental cleanups or, and ship inspections going on. And then there's port security specialists traveling all through the Pacific, working with other international countries to make sure that they have the knowledge and skills in order to make sure that their ports are safe and secure, and that the goods that are flowing in and out of the United States are safe.
And so we hear pretty regularly when one of these shutdowns happens that it's only essential personnel from affected agencies that are going into work, and they're not getting paid and everybody else gets furloughed. So when you were in command of the 14th District during the 2013 shutdown, what happened to your mission? Who was sent home? Who had to come into work? And what fell by the wayside?
So many of the furloughed employees were civilians who had very important jobs, but ones that weren't time essential. And so many of the administrative positions, some of the logistics and maintenance folks over on Sand Island, where we could delay their maintenance for some period of time, were sent on furlough as all. But it was so important for me at the time to try and reassure that just because you were furloughed didn't mean that you weren't important, because the Coast Guard only has, 42,000 men and women on active duty, about 6,000 reservists and 8,000 civilians, and every single employee and military member is important. And just because you're on furlough doesn't mean that you're not important. It just means that we can wait a little bit of time for that mission. And so that was the approach that we used back in 2013.
And so what did that translate to in terms of your ability to conduct normal operations? What missions did you have to maybe put down or give a lower priority than others?
Well, like any Coast Guard day, there's always too much to do and not enough resources in order to do it. And so in any normal day or the times during these shutdowns, you just have to prioritize. And And so at that point, we were focusing on essential maintenance, search and rescue, and immediate port security requirements, and some of the other stuff just got deferred until a little bit later. And we would play some catch up. Some of the units might have to, that were in maintenance periods. It might be another month or two before we could finish their yard periods that were necessary because we couldn't get them done necessarily during the shutdown. So it defers important but not time essential missions.
Now, I have to think, Admiral Thomas, that the equation starts to change the longer a shutdown goes on for, and at some point it's got to be unsustainable for your force to either, some of them are not getting paid, others are not even able to come to work. Was that a concern at all during the 2013 shutdown when you were in command?
Well, during that shutdown, it affected only civilian employees. And again, I just wanted all the civilian employees who were furloughed to know that what they did was very important. And it's no different today. I think today's situation is a little different because while the administration was able to gather some pocket change together and pay the Coast Guard at the end of December, as the Vice Commandant said to the workforce, it doesn't necessarily mean that they will be paid on mid-month. For both the military and the civilians. And that's what is different about this shutdown, is that it could potentially affect both the military and the civilian workforce.
And your organization, Coast Guard Mutual Assistance, has been trying to help the families of service members who are being financially squeezed by this shutdown. What stories have you been hearing from men and women in uniform?
The stories are ones of just uncertainty. And there you have the widest spectrum of people that are well prepared financially for any kind of personal crisis that they might have within themselves or their families, to people that are barely living paycheck to paycheck and everything in between. And so this is sort of a moment of strategic imperatives for each member of the military, each member of the Coast Guard, each civilian employee and their families, to take a good hard look at their own circumstances and make sure that they've got sufficient resources, in the long term so that level of uncertainty doesn't happen again. But you don't get there overnight. And so part of what our charity is working on is providing some financial help to those in most need right now.
It seems like that this shutdown is going to drag on. Both sides seem to have dug in pretty firmly. How long do you think, from your experience in command, how long would it be before the Coast Guard, let's say, is starting to have diminished performance on those time essential tasks that you mentioned earlier that are still being done during the shutdown?
Well, anytime you lag on maintenance, so you think about your car, and you know that you need your tires changed and your oil changed, but you can't afford it right now, and so you put it off. Well, eventually, by not having your tires there, it may turn into your alignment going bad, and pretty soon what might have been a $400 or $500 maintenance turns into maybe $1,000. And so that's part of the challenge when you defer maintenance for longer periods of time. That you've got to then catch up as quickly as you can so that it's not affecting your mission readiness. I will say is that there is a lot of bipartisan support to pay your Coast Guard right now. I know Senator Schatz was one of the bill co-sponsors for a bill that is currently under consideration on the Senate side, the Coast Guard enjoys bipartisan support for the things that the Coast Guard does, and for that, as a charity head, I'm really, really grateful that a lot of people understand that the Coast Guard is a military service, and it deserves to be paid for the work that is necessary in order to keep the country as safe and secure as it's responsible for.
All right, retired Rear Admiral Carrie Thomas, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my privilege. Aloha. Mahalo.
That was Admiral Carrie Thomas talking to us from Washington, D.C. She now runs a nonprofit Coast Guard Mutual Assistance Fund, which is providing financial assistance to Coast Guard service members who are about to miss their first paycheck since the partial shutdown began 24 days ago. If you're interested in donating, we'll have a link posted with this story at hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. One of our listeners shared with us that many years ago, it was commonplace for an insecticide to be applied around the more swampy places in Hawaii. Kids would often ride their bikes or follow the trucks during the spraying and thought nothing of it. Now, contemplating what they inhaled would make most parents quite nervous. But you don't know what you don't know until you do. So what is the name of this colorless, tasteless, and almost odorless crystalline chemical compound? Well, here's a hint. Winston Churchill once called it the excellent powder, and many thought so too until American conservationist Rachel Carson said otherwise. You know this one, don't you? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm David Ulrich from Pacific New Media, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
The Hawaii Supreme Court will hear oral arguments tomorrow that will determine the outcome of a contested race here in Honolulu. The lack of a law on mandatory recounts has several state lawmakers scurrying to draft bills to avoid a similar dilemma in the future. A 22-vote spread is at the heart of an election drama that has City Councilman Trevor Ozawa up against challenger Tommy Waters. The City Council's business is on hold until the Supreme Court decides the way forward. This morning, we talked to incoming Judiciary Chairman Chris Lee about what lawmakers are considering for the upcoming session, which, by the way, starts this week.
I think there's a lot of talk about what can be done because this is clearly a situation which we don't want to repeat in the future. I think it's on us to figure something out so that whoever it is, whatever district it might be the next time, that area has representation that is clear from day one. So with our colleagues, I know there's a number of bills that are being worked on. There's a number of different proposals that are in the works right now that would do a couple different things. And that's streamlining the process so that once you have an election that's concluded and there's a question raised, number one, you have a finite time period to figure that out so that by the end of the year, for example, you'd have some decision rendered one way or another. The other thing is creating some sort of automatic recount or audit process to make sure that when it's within a very slim margin of error, like it was in this race and a couple others, that there's clear procedures in place to figure out what to do next.
The morning paper has a story about how senators are looking at three different versions. I think Senator Gail Ageron tried to introduce something previously. Senator Chang, who was a city council member representing that very district, is also looking at something, and so is Senator Laura Thielen. Was there any attempt in the House in previous sessions to deal with this issue?
I think the issue has been discussed in previous sessions. I think obviously people are really focused on this now because of the urgency and because of the situation before us. And I think it makes sense to take care of it once and for all. So we do know there are some coordinated talks going on between various senators and representatives and committee chairs to figure out what to do. So I would definitely expect this coming week when the legislature opens that there's going to be a flood of proposals moving forward.
And I know everybody's just watching to see what the Supreme Court decides in this area. The whole process has been really interesting just as far as what the cutoff time is for counting absentee votes. That was a real eye-opener for me.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of people didn't really realize that this sort of situation really could happen where you'd have, you know, here we are in January with some sort of resolution yet to be found. But what could be done and what a number of other states already do is either address the problem on the front end or the back end before, for example, requiring that the Office of Elections mail out ballots by a certain date, so say maybe 3 weeks before the election, and that gives people plenty of time to make sure that they get their ballots back in, and then requiring by 6 p.m. that day or some time thereof that is the absolute cutoff, and people have had plenty of time to put their ballots in, and after that, nothing else will be accepted. Alternatively, you could go the other way and do what some other states have done and say, all right, people will mail things in as long as the ballot is postmarked by election day, it will be counted. And that, of course, introduces the possibility of several days thereafter of ballots coming in and continuing to be counted. So we've got to decide which way we want to go of either of these, if this is the case, to make sure we ultimately don't end up in this situation again and we don't end up in court over what time and what day the ballots are mailed and counted and so forth.
Tommy Waters went to bed thinking he was probably ahead, or he was ahead, and then to have that reversed, it's such drama that we could do without, I think.
Yeah, you can't make this stuff up in even House of Cards. And that's something that I think, at the very least, is engaging a lot of people into the process, which is exciting. So hopefully we can make something of it this year and really move forward, at least at the state level.
There are so many of the absentee ballots that have not been counted. I think there's several hundred, and I don't believe they know exactly how many might be in the East Honolulu district that could affect the outcome of that race. But, yeah, it's just so close.
Absolutely. But, you know, I mean, this really does bring up bigger questions that I think are seeing momentum to try and tackle, not just how we count an election and the procedures surrounding that, but really, how do we engage more people in our civic process to begin with and have elections that are more relevant for more of the population and ultimately come out with better results? And there's a whole slew of other proposals to really figure out how to rethink Hawaii's election process to begin with. And that's something that really opens up a lot of ideas. And then even make this conversation about date and time and how we count ballots ultimately moot.
On another subject, a recent case on the impeachment process has come into the limelight, and it appears that the recall law is pretty clear, but impeachment is not. Is there anything that you folks will be looking at to tighten up that?
Yeah, you know, I think with that issue, that's another one that's been in the news. I think more of the conversation that I've heard and been a part of is trying to wait and see, first of all, what's happening with that situation and ultimately where that goes, because it's hard to make an assessment for really what needs to be done without having all the facts and the details. So if anything is going to be addressed anytime in the near future, I would imagine it would be specific to creating some sort of clear rules or statute around what constitutes an impeachable offense and how that works. But we haven't seen anything specific yet.
The court is in this head-scratching situation because the law is not clear-cut. I believe it is for recall, and I do remember the whole recall process at the Honolulu City Council when Patsy Mink tried to get those three councilmen a recall because they switched parties midstream. And that was, more drama, late afternoon decisions coming down and everybody trying to figure out, gosh, we've never done this before. We've got to tread carefully. So in this particular case of impeachment, where someone has initiated this petition drive to impeach Honolulu City Prosecutor Keith Kaneshiro, it's just another area of uncharted territory.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think we got to be careful that we don't end up like some other places. And there's a great example of like Wisconsin and others where, regardless of party, you've had significant petition drives and recall elections, not really always based on malfeasance or some sort of bad action, but rather just as the next step in divisive party politics, where you have parties who lose an election and then immediately figure out how to recall the actual winner. And that's something that I think is really dangerous in a way, because you're disenfranchising the will of the voters of a particular district. So we really got to tread carefully to make sure that if there's an impeachment that's warranted, number one, it's for real bad action and cause, and then two, that there's very clear processes that protect the will of the voters in that area and make sure that this isn't just something that's being launched by, you know, some corporate interest spending a lot of money to pull somebody out of office that they don't like or what have you. It's really got to transcend party politics.
Do you think you'll be introducing anything in regard to impeachment?
Hard to say yet. You know, I think we're working on about 85 or 90 bills right now, trying to narrow it down to a real handful. So I think we're going to figure out in the next probably 2 or 3 days what's on the list. Whether or not that makes it, I think, hard to say yet. There's definitely some other bigger fish to fry. And that being said, I mean, it's very possible that there's a number of our other colleagues that put something in that will end up coming through our committee and we'll have a real discussion about.
Okay. All right. Well, Representative Lee, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
That was Representative Chris Lee, House Judiciary Chair, talking about how lawmakers are looking at ways to clarify our election laws when it comes to recounts and impeachment. Legislators are also having a conversation about bills dealing with online voting and runoffs in an effort to increase public participation in our electoral process. The legislative session starts Wednesday, the day after tomorrow.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Diamond Head Theater, presenting the comedy Noises Off, a farce about a play within a play from a backstage perspective, opening Friday, January 25th. DiamondHeadTheater.com.
It's now time for our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Pedestrian safety is a big emphasis in an effort to avoid the soaring fatality cases that we saw last year. Reporter Kirsten Downey has a follow-up story about missing crosswalks. Morning. Tell us now, we did have our first pedestrian fatality, a gentleman who was near a crosswalk that was painted over accidentally or mistakenly.
Yes, an 86-year-old, unfortunately, was hit and killed just last week on a busy stretch in Hawaii Kai. This has been a part of the roadways of Honolulu that's been very carefully considered in the last couple years because of the increasing rate of pedestrian deaths. As part of our Coconut Wireless series of stories, sort of looking at taking micro looks at different neighborhoods of Honolulu, we took a look, and particularly at this place up a stretch of Ainahaina between Wa'a Street and about Wailupi Circle, where several crosswalks and bus stops had been moved recently, partially as a way to try to reduce the danger of pedestrian deaths there. And what we found when we talked to neighbors is many of them were very unhappy about what's happened as a result. Bus stops were moved, crosswalks were eliminated. It's made it more difficult for people to walk from the mountainside of Ainahaina to get to the ocean, and it's made it harder for people to go places by bus.
And there was a fatality.
Yes, of course, the one in Hawaii Kai just mm-hmm. recently. But the changes to the crosswalks and bus stops that I'm talking about in this particular stretch between Wa'a and Wailupe Circle came as a result of two deaths, and most particularly one of a very beloved Kaiser Permanente doctor named Cynthia Tim Soneda, who was killed back in 2015. So in 2016, the city and state proposed a number of changes to crosswalks and bus stops in that area to help prevent further accidents and deaths. But the neighbors who lived there weren't aware this was happening, and within the last 6 months realized with shock that decisions had been made that would have a big impact on their quality of life.
And they have addressed this at the neighborhood board, haven't they?
Yes, they did. It was thoroughly discussed at the neighborhood board starting back in October 2016. But one of the problems we have in Hawaii is a lot of people don't pay very good attention to the political process. And although this was being thoroughly discussed, the neighbors on Ka'ai Street, which have been most affected by this, were unaware that it happened until they saw a small sign on their bus stop saying that the bus stops were going to be moved, and the crosswalks were simply just removed one day.
And I know that stretch of highway is very busy. I was just there yesterday. Unfortunately, left my wallet on top of my car as I was putting something in the back, and it fell off on Kalani on the Iole Highway. And I remember thinking, I was standing in front of the fire station thinking, okay, if I'm going to get hit, I guess this is a good place to be hit because the first responders are still there. But it's busy there.
It is really busy. They, you know, when they built those subdivisions, it was like a little two-lane road, road passing through there. And now they have 80,000 cars a day. Not only that, it's just where cars come off the H1 freeway. So they're accustomed to driving really fast. And although the speed limit is 35 miles an hour, if you drive through at 35 miles an hour, everybody is whizzing past you and you feel like you're going too slow. That makes it almost impossible for people to safely cross the street. And that's why these particular crosswalks were singled out. They're in a very busy stretch of the road, and also they have no traffic signals. They're what they call unsignalized crosswalks. That made them particularly dangerous. On the other hand, once you take out the unsignalized crosswalks, that meant that the bus stops had to be moved as well so that they would be closer crosswalks. So you end up losing bus stops as well. Now, this is a policy of removing crosswalks and changing bus stops that the city and state have been embarked on all around Oahu. The decisions have been unpopular in many places. In fact, former Republican State Senator Sam Slom has called it a very short-sighted policy by the state because you're maybe reducing pedestrian deaths, but you're doing it at the expense of elderly people who have to walk a lot further to cross or
that's
to get
right
up to the bus, and younger people simply jaywalking.
Yeah, that's a good point. Thanks so much, Kirsten.
Thank you so much.
That was reporter Kirsten Downey with today's reality check. To read her full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Looking for a pledge and listener experience producer. This dynamic team player will have the responsibility of producing our semi-annual fund drives and outreach activities. If you have a background in events coordination or broadcast production with experience managing cross-functioning teams, check out the employment opportunities page on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
With the new tax law come new tax breaks and a whole lot of new rules, leaving accountants to figure them out.
They were all freaking out like, oh my God, how are we ever going to explain this to our clients and how are we ever going to put this into practice?
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Look, wasn't tax reform supposed to make things easier? That's next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6.
It's later than we think. What to do about rising waters? Well, that's what scientists and policymakers are talking about at a conference in Honolulu today. HBR's Ku'uwehi Hiraishi joins us with the lowdown.
Morning. Yes. Aloha, Catherine. So this Hawaii Climate Conference, sort of the big, first big taking on of Kuleana from this commission. So folks might remember back in 2017, Governor Ige, David Ige, sort of enacted the first, was the first state to enact legislation to kind of stick with the Paris Agreement. So in sort of taking that on, this commission was created, and it's sort of heads of all different county agencies, planning commissions, and some of our state departments and experts, local experts, who are trying to figure out how to prioritize the response to climate change. Everyone sees this. We see it out in the community and coastal erosion, or extreme weather events. These are things that we see every day. This commission is trying to figure out how to implement changes so that we can mitigate it and also adapt to it. So this conference is sort of bringing in national and local experts to have this these deeper discussions on how to implement that. So they've come up in this last year, I think some folks might remember the sea level rise vulnerability report and adaptation report. So that was sort of the first product coming out of this commission. And this conference is sort of going to call out more from that discussion to figure out what they can actually do in terms of having actual policies implemented. So I spoke to Anu Hiddle. She's the coordinator for the Hawaii Climate Change Mitigation and Adaptation Commission, who's hosting today's conference. And she kind of runs into the two main focuses for the commission, at least for this year, the two priorities.
The commission's focus has been primarily on the mitigation side, on ground transportation issues, and they're looking at how to reduce emissions from that. Even though Hawaii doesn't have a huge global footprint, we do have emissions, and per capita emissions not as high as U.S. mainland average, but it is very high compared to the rest of the world's average. So that's one thing that we're looking at, and the commission is also focused on the adaptation side, very importantly for Hawaii, on the sea level rise issues and the impacts and how to adapt to those. So
today is all about action and figuring out, okay, these are what this is where we want to be. What can we do? So on the sea level rise discussions, I guess, or that side of it, it's trying to figure out how to direct development away from our coastal areas. It's trying to get landowners who have assets or have homes or infrastructure in these low-lying coastal areas to make sure they have a plan for adapting to sea level rise so that it's not like, all of a sudden this, you know, sewer system just wipes out on the road. So those discussions are going to be had today. And then on the ground transportation side, it's stuff like coming up with a better regulatory framework for car sharing, because we do know, especially here on Oahu, that's been hard to figure out. When it comes to parking and things like ownership of whatever parking space is going to be used for car sharing. So lots of interesting discussions. A sort of general theme that I thought was really interesting is the commission has been trying to make sure that all these discussions are had not just through or seen, not just through a climate lens, but through an equity lens. So is this something that if we're going to take on this strategy for adapting to climate change, is this something that is only available to certain households or income households? Or is this something that everyone can easily transition to? So Hiddle says that is sort of the common thread of all. That was the main keynote speaker was talking about that this morning. But all the other discussions are going to try to weave that into it. So she kind of gives us an idea of an example of what equity should look like.
I've heard equity talked about as a, if you've heard of sidewalk cuts, yeah, and how sidewalk cuts are by law for the people who are, it's for handicap accessible and for people to be able to get, you know, from the road to the sidewalk and mm-hmm. vice versa. But really, everybody uses it, right? So people who've got babies and strollers, people who've got bicyclists, skateboarders, all these folks use it. But so it's just that one thing for one segment of the population lifts everybody. It makes life easier for everybody. And that's what we'd like to see with climate strategies that are clean, equitable, and resilient, is that you lift everybody.
So, yeah, it is, because I think a lot of times when policymakers get together and have these discussions, that part of the equation isn't usually at the top of their mind. But I think with the high cost of living here in Hawaii, it was something that the commission was very cognizant of, and in having these conversations, those are the questions they're going to be asking these experts. You know, okay, carbon tax, but that's essentially regressive because, you know, folks with a lot of money can't really make that transition easily. So what Hiddo had brought up or suggested was, what about moving that tax higher up the income stream and putting it on the producers or the importers or someone else that can afford it, you know, and it may trickle down, but at least sort of doing it in a way that everyone can come on board with.
I know I've seen a report where I think it's Florida that's looking at the same kind of a thing, you know, very similar to Hawaii, but they were looking at neighborhoods that might be impacted and where there is more of a impact on those lower folks on the lower tier. So, yeah, lots to really think about as we plan ahead.
Exactly. I think I can't remember the name of the expert from Florida, but she or he is also on the agenda today in terms of figuring out how to – that's right, Dr. Jennifer Jurado from Broward County, trying to figure out how to pay for these. So there were three panels today, one on sea level rise, another on ground transportation, and the third is really that big question of how do we fund all these, pie in the sky hopes and goals and make it work.
Right, and we have to hurry up.
And we have to hurry up. That is also there.
The water's rising. All right, thanks so much, Kuvehi. That was Kuvehi Hiraishi talking about a gathering at the East-West Center where the focus is climate change. You can find her full story at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, I'm Swain from Stage Left Productions. You're tuned in to Hawaii Public Radio. Find our stories on Twitter or tweet us at HI Conversation.
This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with University of Hawaii astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer.
Stargazer time. Our look into the massive universe around us and what we can look for in our dark skies. As usual, turning to the expertise of Christopher Phillips, we've got him on the line right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Venus in the early morning just before sunrise, and also look out for Mars in the western sky after sunset. The moon this week is approaching its full phase, and so spotting those faint objects in the heavens will be very challenging towards week's end.
And you've got an update on those mysterious radio bursts.
Yes, there's been quite a buzz recently about the fast radio bursts detected coming from deep space. These bursts of radio energy last only a few milliseconds, and only one of them has ever been found to repeat. That is until now. A Canadian instrument known as CHIME, or the Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment, has found a second repeating radio burst in the distant universe. And the team that discovered it are expecting to find more. And if so, this could mark a major development in the discovery of these mysterious bursts of energy.
Sometimes you hear that there is an outside chance that possibly these signals might have something to do with any kind of other civilization or something like that. What's your thought on that?
Well, part of the confusion is that word signal. In astronomy, we refer to everything we see in the night sky as having a signal. A variable star, a supernova, an active galaxy. We identify all of these objects by the signal that we receive here on Earth. This often gets lost in the translation when the story makes it to the media, because to everyone outside of astronomy, a signal means a radio broadcast, like ours right now.
And these radio bursts, then, clearly not somebody trying to communicate with Earth.
Definitely not. If they came from the same same location and we're repeating, then we might have another story on our hands. But the truth is that these bursts are not localized. They appear to be random, which leads us to believe that we are actually looking at something natural.
And what's the real explanation, you think?
Well, my guess, it's something very, very energetic, like colliding neutron stars or black holes. Or it might be a type of high-energy event that we simply haven't seen before. Either way, we'll keep watching the skies.
Christopher Phillips, and another informative report. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer, which we keep at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to create, maintain, and preserve open spaces for the Maui community. More at haleakalaranch.com.
Early in the show, we talked about a time when a certain chemical was routinely released to combat parasites and pesky insects carrying viral diseases, often in the evening, in many places around Hawaii. Well, one of our listeners said he and his friends often followed the truck on their bikes and often caught more than a few fumes from the chemical cloud. You may be cringing at that thought. We asked you to identify the substance, and if you said it was DDT, well, you're right. Although the pesticide is banned in many countries, some countries in Africa, Asia, and South America continue to employ the pesticide for mosquito control in order to reduce the risk of malaria. The EPA banned the domestic use of DDT in 1972, but it can be used in the U.S. for public health emergencies, such as controlling vector disease. And congratulations to Warren of Wailuku. He says he was one of those kids running behind the trucks. He remembers that all the kids got excited by the spraying, which happened at night. Woo-ha. All right, well, that's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, you can send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. The restaurant business is a competitive one. Old favorites shut down as new eateries pop up. So many options, so little time to try them all. But if you're in the business, heads up, there's a new free training opportunity to get ahead thanks to a federal workforce development grant from the Department of Labor. Program coordinator Marcus Fixie tells us about a 25-week online manager training program coming up at Kapi'olani Community College.
We have a new program. It's called the Hawaii Hospitality and Restaurant Management Apprenticeship Program. So I know that's a long name, but the main beef of that is that it's an apprenticeship program designed specifically to train and elevate restaurant and hospitality managers, either who are currently working as managers in restaurants or hotels, or who are working in those establishments but in different positions and are interested in elevating themselves into those positions. So this is a free 25-week program where the participants will go through a series of five classes. They're what we call at KCC, we call them hybrid classes because the classes themselves are online, but the testing is in person. And the great thing about this program, speaking of testing, is this is actually available to anyone statewide because they can take their classes online, and then we're in the process right now of working with our testing centers at our sister schools to be able to have them just go there rather than having to come here for testing.
Great. So you could go to Maui College if that's your island.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So the specifically what they'll be learning is they'll get a manager-level ServSafe certification. So they'll take safety and sanitation at the manager level. They'll take hospitality and restaurant marketing, hospitality human resource management, and they'll take cost control as well. So, yeah, these are really great programs that are that will work them towards what's called an MFP or Manage First Professional Credential. So if they complete all five of those classes, they'll get an MFP, which is a certification issued by the National Restaurant Association. It's a credential that they can put on their resume. And everything is completely covered through a grant through the Office of Workforce Development, except for the textbooks. So the textbooks are either the responsibility of the employer that sends them through the program or the apprentice, and that's up to the employer to decide whether or not they want to cover that expense. It's a little under $400 for the five classes.
Okay, but otherwise the class itself is free.
Yep. All tuition, all related expenses are totally covered, and the classes are all taught by our faculty. And then, if you don't mind, I do have one other program to talk about as well, which is our cook apprentice program. So we're about to start our fourth round of this program, whereas the restaurant manager apprentice program is brand new. So the cook apprentice program is 30 weeks long, and instead of being a hybrid program, that one's actually in person. So those participants will also take safety and sanitation, but that rather than the manager level, they'll be the food handler, which is the required certification to work in food service. They'll also take menu merchandising or menu planning, so that helps them to learn how to design a menu if they're interested in becoming an executive chef. They will take culinary nutrition as well, and then they'll take a class called Intro to Food Service, which is a little bit front of the house, a little bit back of the house training. And then the biggest portion of the program is a hands-on fundamentals lab class, where they'll learn everything from how to chop to all the mother sauces to chicken fabrication, everything from beginning to end in a six-hour class. So it's once a week for 6 hours for 30 weeks.
And is that a class just offered here in Honolulu? Or?
That one is only here at Kapi'olani Community College.
Okay, but still, a great opportunity for professional advancement if this is your area. I mean, my gosh, what a wonderful opportunity.
Yeah, we're really proud of this program. We really are excited to be able to offer it to the community. We did a lot of market research and talked to a lot of people in the industry, and we really understand that the need for this program is strong because we have such a quickly expanding industry and so many open positions and so many incredible opportunities that the truth is that it is easy to walk in and get a job in the industry. But just like the example I always like to use is if you could become a lawyer tomorrow without going to law school, who wouldn't do it? But you might get on the first day in the job and realize that was a bad idea. So if you can walk into a restaurant because they're really desperate for employees right now and you don't need to go to college first, then oftentimes people are taking advantage of those opportunities and then realizing that they could really use a little extra training once they get in there. And then at that point, it's difficult to work it around their schedule. So this is designed specifically for people who are already working full time.
So you could either take it at night if you have a day job.
That's right. Yeah. So the classes are for the Cook Apprentice program, the classes are either Fridays or Sundays. They can choose mornings or afternoons. And then, again, for the Manager Apprentice program, they can do those whenever works for them. They just have to come in for testing once every 5 weeks.
And then can you share with us, I don't know if you know, but what was the genesis of this? Why is it that we have this grant?
That's a great question. So this grant comes because of our what we call the principal investigator, who is the former chair of the culinary department. His name's Ron Takahashi. He just stepped down his chair and is now a culinary instructor. And this was his brainchild. He knew through a full career in the industry and owning multiple restaurants, working for different hotels, he understood the need for this program more than anyone. And so he actually created or came up with the idea to apply for the money from the state level. And once that was approved, he hired the team, including myself and the rest of us, and he formed the program that way.
So he really saw the need just through his work, mm-hmm. that there was this gap.
Yeah, that's right. And it's been very successful. Through the Cook Apprentice program, for the first three rounds, we've had over 200 cooks take part in the program from over 50 restaurants in Honolulu.
That's terrific. And so I know the State Health Department is real big on sanitation rules and they're cracking down because we had several instances where people got sick. They've closed down restaurants, which was quite rare before.
Mm-hmm.
But they're just drawing the line, saying, look, you can get ill from this. You could even die if you've got bad product. And so how do we spot this early? How do we curb the problem, you know, nip it in the bud before it spreads.
That's right. And we really emphasize that in our programs, too. The first classes that you take in both of the programs, and this, of course, is especially important for our Cook Apprentice program, the first thing they do before they're allowed to step foot in the kitchen is take our safety and sanitation class and pass that class, get their ServSafe certification, and then they're allowed to walk into the kitchen. And we make it very clear why that's important. And you're right, it is. It's not just for their safety. It's for the, you're working with the public. You're putting things out there. As we all know, this goes down the whole chain. Oftentimes, food safety is also comes from the producer themselves who's making the meat or the milk or wherever. Oftentimes when we have national problems in this way, we can trace it back to one particular source that is distributing throughout the whole country. And who knows if this person that we're training today to be a cook might eventually get a job working in a place like that. We need to make sure that they understand the importance of safety.
That was Program Coordinator Marcus Fixie talking about a new free restaurant training program at KCC. For links, check our Facebook page, The Conversation HPR.
It's something that I do and listen to every day. So if I want to ensure that it's available for me tomorrow, the next month, a year from now, as well as others, then what is it to just, you know, contribute a little bit here every month? It's very simple. I don't, you know, it's just, it's something that was very logical. So I just signed up and been contributing ever since. My name is Elise from Wailuku, Maui, and I am proud to be a sustaining member.
Our time is up. We do have to go. But up tomorrow, we bust sleep myths. It's a call-in show. We do want to hear from you. You can call our talk back line and leave us your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217, or call in your questions on the live show. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.